32 million Americans have used psychedelics in the last 12 months. And I was one of those that didn't understand the value of having support, guidance, container, intentionality, and setting within the psychedelic experience. I used it for fun, and I used it for connection with people.
Are you in the process of creating something huge, and you want to understand how others have done it? Or have you already found success and still feel something is missing? Then this podcast is for you. Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge, a podcast where Alex Atwood chats with top performers to discover habits, routines, and alchemy that you can put to work in your own life.
So today I'm going to be talking to my great friend, Austin Mao. Austin is a psychedelic assisted therapy facilitator. He's an entrepreneur in the world of real estate. He's founder of an entheogenic church. He has also helped dozens of entrepreneurs and founders, ranging from Fortune 500 to Silicon Valley unicorn executives to therapists, accelerate their lives and their companies and find true purpose, peace, love, joy, and fulfillment. His journey, which we will learn about, began in 2016 when he spent the last 6 months of his father's life by his bedside with him as he slowly succumbed to cancer. He put his tech startup on indefinite hold, and he committed to rebuilding a strained relationship, which is what he had at the time with his father. So he has a true belief in the synthesis of science and shamanism. His practice bridges the founder's journey with a deep background in psychology and spirituality. He's a fascinating guy, and I am really excited to talk to him. So let's start the interview. Austin Mao, so good to see you.
So good to see you, Alex.
So I was reading your questionnaire, the pre-interview questionnaire that we gave, and I noticed that you had put choiceless clarity. And so this really caught my attention when I was reading through that pre-interview, and I thought I knew you very well, and I thought I knew some of the things that you sort of lived by. But when I read that, it intrigued me. So tell me about that.
Thank you for asking. Choiceless clarity is a way of being that is something that I discovered through a lot of self-work in my life. I discovered that when I'm in a state of uncertainty, of confusion, that generates a lot of stress and anxiety, grief, apathy, resentment in my life. And the choiceless clarity comes from my attunement to my inner truth. And I know that sounds a bit abstract. The process to get to choiceless clarity is to really fully feel my feelings and then surrender them, release them. So I've gone through this process of really examining all the pieces of my life that I've been ignoring, all the fears that have been guiding me subconsciously towards avoidance, and really just cleaning house, addressing everything from a place of truthfulness.
Yeah, so that's beautiful. And the reason why I led with that is because you have gone through quite a transformation, and I want to learn more about Austin growing up. I want to learn what your childhood was like, and I want to go through that journey with you so I can, you know, get a deeper understanding. So tell me about that. You know, what was your childhood like and where did you grow up? Give me that scene.
I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles, single son to a single mother, parents divorced when about half a year old, and grew up really without a father. My origin story kind of begins sometime around 9 years old when my mother broke up with the love of her life. I didn't know it at the time, but I sat with her. She was just crying, sobbing on the floor, and consoling her, singing to her. And what that's done, that kind of moment, is something that I really reflect on, because my whole life has been dedicated towards healing in one way or another. And that's both been, you know, my greatest grace as well as my greatest trials, because it's manifested as, you know, the energy by which I can come from and hold safe space and really care for and love others. But it's also led to a pridefulness within myself, an egoness in myself. So my childhood, I was raised in a very Asian American area, got good grades, you know, didn't drink, didn't even touch alcohol or even really know what that was until college. So all of this is kind of in retrospect because I really discovered who I was again about 2.5 years ago when I regained my memories after visiting some repressed trauma that I had. Mm. So I'm more able to answer this now.
Yeah. Well, I really want to learn what some of those early memories that made you feel alive. So you grew up in a single parent household, immigrant family, right? And obviously you had the ability to do well in school. And that's something that I resonate with, being also from an immigrant family. So when at that age, you know, what made you feel alive? What was it that you really enjoyed doing maybe between 9 and 12 as you're going into your teenage years? So it's a very innocent time, right? And I want to see when you started discovering your passions.
I always see praise. You know, I had a really strong need for validation as a kid. And that might look like getting good grades. It also looked like getting accolades from extracurriculars and whatnot. So I just joined as many clubs as I could. Science club, math club, speech and debate, so on and so forth, you know. And I always walked around with a chip on my shoulder, thinking I was better than everybody else as a kid, all the way to adulthood. What really, really lit me up is when I could excel in something. I really excelled in math, and I really excelled in literature and writing. And I enjoyed both of those extensively.
Ah, got it. So you found your creative source at that age that you were able to create.
Yeah.
Yes.
I had started writing poetry at a really early age. And in high school, you could find me walking around with a book of Shakespeare, you know, partially because I loved reading poetry, and also partially because I got my own egoic kick out of other people seeing that I was reading Shakespeare.
And what age was this?
Probably 16-ish.
Yeah. So then you go to school. Where'd you go to university?
UC San Diego.
UC San Diego. Right. So you're this innocent boy who is a poet, who has a soft soul, a creative soul. And now here you are in UC San Diego. So was there a shift there? Did you start to put your entrepreneurial scaffolding together at that point?
Yeah. So what was interesting is I expected myself to be able to get into a better school, like an Ivy League or a higher UC. And because I didn't, I met my own disappointment in myself with overwork. Mm-hmm. So I did a double major in 3 years. I really worked the system and, you know, was taking an exorbitant amount of classes while also running like the biggest club on campus and whatnot. And so I very much became an overachiever to compensate for my own disappointment in myself. And very shortly, I think in the first summer, I got an internship at a brokerage where ultimately I ended up becoming a broker and then graduated and became a partner in the firm. Mm. So right off of that, kind of became an entrepreneur, but not from the right place of enjoyment and love, but from a place of just trying to compensate for something.
Yeah, that's a lot of people's entrepreneurial journey. And sometimes that fuel turns toxic. And we'll get to that later. So tell me about like your lifestyle when you began the entrepreneurial journey, right? So now you've used that skill set that you built, right? That winning formula of overachieving due to some sort of fear that was there, and which came with a nice fat ego. And so that ego, you know, obviously lifted you to new heights. So tell me about that. You were in a comfortable job. You were doing well. You know, obviously you'd done well for yourself at that point. When did the entrepreneurial side of you begin to show up?
Well, I was an entrepreneur right out of the gate of college and have been an entrepreneur ever since. So, you know, I had and always have had a propensity for efficiency. And so at the age of 22, 23, I was managing and scaling this brokerage firm that I had with two other partners. Where I really became the entrepreneur that I am today is a few years later, I started a tech company, had some significant investors, and then I just got really unhappy, really fat, dissatisfied with my job, really passionless and kept changing stream all the time. And I had a pivotal moment where I sat with a guru in LA, and her name is Candace Silvers. And she looked me in the eyes and said, "Austin, you're a child. And, you know, fear is usually an indication of something you should do." So I went to the Starbucks next door and I made a list of all the things that I feared to do. And I started to check those off the list. In the span of 6 months, I had quit my own company, let it fail. I started a whole new one with the intention of not working during the 4-hour work week. I lost 50 pounds. I moved to the beach. And after about 6 months, I did end up getting the 4-hour work week in internet marketing. And so I did that for about 10 years of just really not working very much and creating a cash flow business that allowed me to travel the world and sustain my lifestyle.
So that is probably what a lot of people would say is the ideal picture of success, right? You were able to get yourself to a point where do as you wanted and contain your work to 4 hours. And you're adopting all these rituals and methods. They're helping you stay productive, you know, right? And they're helping you to adapt. First of all, tell me a little bit about those. And then what was missing in all of that production, right? Because you were producing at a high level. And, you know, I know you, and I know there was a shift between then and now where you discovered quite a bit. So I'd like to learn for the people that are watching or listening who may not have been able to synthesize something like the 4-hour work. It may seem like, you know, frankly, for me, it seems as though it's something that is beyond my reach just based on, you know, how much I do. So I'd like to learn about that.
So the very foundation of that kind of level of efficiency is a change in mindset, prioritizing time over money. How often did I choose to work with this client that was causing me a lot of stress or anxiety and annoyance and occupying a lot of time because they produced a lot of revenue for me, you know? And when I shifted my priority for time and energy, what I started to do is make shifts in every aspect of my life, particularly my business. So when I would say that my time is worth X, so let's say my time is worth $500 an hour, then anything that could save me an hour, I should be willing to pay $500 for, right? And so I would actively fire clients because they would not serve me or serve that mental framework that I had, which allowed me to really prioritize the ones that really didn't give me trouble and free up my energy to discover more that didn't give me trouble, right? And that's just a small like picture of what opportunities open up when one has that kind of level of prioritization and intentionality around their time and their energy. Yeah. And I would do this across my whole life. For example, when I was single and online dating, I automated that by hiring a team of virtual assistants in the Philippines to log in. This is before Tinder. Log in as me on Match.com and Harmony and whatnot, and send messages. And I was A/B testing different messages. And ultimately, you know, whereas normally men would have a lot of difficulty even securing a single date a week, I had 2-3 dates a day.
Date hacking.
Date hacking, exactly. So that's just an example of what is possible when we value our time, right?
Yeah.
And actually assigning like a dollar value to that time, because I was willing to pay external teams to do this work for me, because online dating takes a lot of time, you know?
Wow. We could probably do a whole episode just on what you just what you just threw out there.
Past life. Yeah.
Yeah. So would you consider that time in your life when you had all those methods, all those rituals that were allowing you to evolve and adapt into this super productive, almost, you know, superhuman? And then you now have a spiritual journey that I think is supported by that. But I want to know, when did your spiritual journey begin as it is today?
My spiritual journey began about 6 years ago when I received a call from my uncle saying, hurry back to Taiwan, your father is about to pass away. I was so shocked because I had seen him the week before, and all he did was complain about his stomach ache. When I went there, found out that he had stage 4 liver cancer. There was kind of a botched surgery. Ultimately, you know, his sepsis was cured, and I got to spend the last 6 months of his life bedside with him. So during that experience, it was so transformative for me because I hadn't had much of a relationship at all with my father. And I got to really sit by his side and guide both of us to a place of peacefulness, of gratitude, and of acceptance. You know, there's a line in a poem that I wrote where I say, thank you, death, for letting me hold my father's hand as I whispered, I love you, on his last breath. That was the beginning of my conscious journey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's deep. So you came from that with a different perspective on things, I suppose. So how did that manifest itself into the lifestyle that you were living at that point?
So interesting. A few months before I heard about my father having this ailment, I had started another tech company I was very excited about in the advertising space and raised some funding, you know. And then when I heard my father get sick, I thought I could code this platform, this prototype from the hospital room, and I just couldn't. I returned their money. I lost a bunch of my own. And when I came back, you know, after that, came back to the United States after that whole experience, my entire framing of life had shifted. I really understood what is important in life. It's not chasing after meaning or chasing after money as my father had for so long. It's really experience, the experience of life, joyfulness, mm-hmm. gratitude, loving others, loving myself. Mm-hmm. And so I got to really grieve him and let that go at the Burning Man a few months later. And then I started another business, an Airbnb business in Las Vegas, which over the course of the next 4 years, it's another lifestyle business, another crack at the 4-hour work week. And in the span of the next 4 years, became the largest Airbnb operator in Vegas. So,
would you consider that a lifestyle business at that point?
What was so interesting is there were spurts where I would be extraordinarily busy, you know, such as acquiring a new home and remodeling it, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I would kind of return back to a status quo of working somewhere between 2 to 8 hours a week. Yeah. So still kind of was pretty good at putting the right people in the right seats to manage the business without me.
Fascinating. Wow. So, okay. I just wrote an article not too long ago about the lifestyle business. And what I'm really, you know, discovering is that you have mastered and perfected the art of building a business that is in balance with lifestyle, whatever lifestyle that you happen to choose. So that is an absolute superpower that I'm learning as I'm talking to you about this. Let's shift gears just a bit, because I want to learn about your experience with psychedelics, specifically plant medicine journeys. Where did psychedelics begin to synthesize into your life journey?
About 2.5 years ago, I went to an ayahuasca retreat called One Heart, and I was invited by a dear friend named Keith. When I went to that journey, I had a chip on my shoulder because I had done psychedelics maybe 100 times over the course of 10 years of Burning Man. And so I thought I was going into a networking event. Well, it was in for an awakening. On the second night of ceremony, right before I had asked the shaman who, it was this beautiful blonde woman. You know, normally I thought of a shaman as someone wearing Native American garb or chanting and whatnot. This woman was a practicing clinical psychologist for 10 years, turned shaman. And I asked her, I have very little access to my memories. Like, what is that? You know, I can barely remember my childhood. And she said, well, in the psychological sense, we might do a bunch of tests, but tonight you ask grandmother ayahuasca. And so when I went into the experience with a very high dose, I relived my memories with vivid detail. I felt like I could remember the locker combination. I could count the blades of grass. And I was just going back and back and back in time. And ultimately, I discovered that as a young child, I was sexually molested by one of my mother's boyfriends at the time. And that experience led me to repress all of my memories throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I started tracing forward in time in my psychedelic experience and understanding the ramifications that had all through my life, culminating in the moment I was at right that moment, filled with intense gratitude because, you know, I felt like I was cured of Alzheimer's. I could remember my memories. So since that time, I've dedicated my life to psychedelic-assisted therapy, to plant medicine. I've been in service within ayahuasca retreats. I've created frameworks and spiritual guides, and very recently just formed a church in Colorado called Ceremonia to legally serve this sacrament, these plant medicines, because of their transformational nature and ability to help us tap into our souls.
So had you had not gone to that networking event, your story you were going through prior to telling me about what you discovered in the ayahuasca journey, you never discovered that pivotal moment that was just right under the surface, but was, you know, clearly controlling a lot. And so that's something that maybe a lot of people don't know about plant medicine journeys or psychedelics, is that they serve a purpose of shining light and uncovering things that you can also find in other ways, but it's a very direct route to that. And I've heard that from multiple people. So you started the psychedelic journey, and it sounds like a Burning Man, because you said you had done, you'd taken part in psychedelic, I guess you would call it a ceremony. I think Burning Man can be called a ceremony to a certain degree. Was that your first experience with psychedelics outside of a ceremony? Is that where it started?
My very first one was when I was 21, visiting Amsterdam. And I didn't touch psychedelics for many years after that, because that one was so big, so much of an experience. I was scared of it.
Yeah. And it definitely didn't take on the same impact that it began to take on when you started to live your life with intention. So in a way, the name of this show is The Alchemist Lounge. And as we chat, I look for alchemy. And so it's clearly there in how your life has manifested itself into something that is more aligned with supporting others that are going through this journey. You know, your vulnerability is, first of all, I mean, it's really appealing, and it really energizes the conversation. And I appreciate you sharing that with the audience. And as I'm hearing about your story about, you know, being highly productive, being able to work 4 hours a week and run lifestyle businesses that allow you to travel the world, that seems to be the peak to most people. Most people would describe that as saying, well, I have it all. And yet you're here and you're talking about something completely in a different plateau. And it feels as though you're much more nourished. So I invite anyone who's interested in psychedelics or curious to look into organizations like One Heart and into having psychedelic assisted therapy facilitators if you choose to take that path, which leads to my next question. Tell me about, you know, your work as a therapy facilitator. Why is that necessary? And how does that serve those who are starting to take the path with plant medicine, or really just sort of the path into that specific spiritual realm?
32 million Americans have used psychedelics in the last 12 months. 32 million.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. 12% of Americans.
It's a great statistic.
Right? It is a great statistic. And I was one of those 32 million that didn't understand the value of having support, guidance, container, intentionality, set and setting within the psychedelic experience. I used it for fun, and I used it for connection with people. I would glean some insight into who I am and why I am the way that I am, but I didn't know how to seat that in the 3D world when I would come down from the high, right? What facilitators, guides, coaches, therapists, shamans, whatever you want to call them, right? What they're able to do is help contextualize the profound experience, the profound psychedelic experience, into the inner workings of our daily life and help us navigate the integration of what insights we receive via psychedelics. And these may be psychological insights, aka, you know, looking at traumas, looking at patterns, looking at fears. They might be spiritual, connection to God, oneness, connection to spirit. They might be physical, right? Might identify ailments in the body, identify weaknesses, identify things that we want to change and grow into to find higher enlightenment, right? To integrate those ideas into who we are as we walk around this beautiful world. So there's a great book that I love called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And, you know, when you shared the reflection about my kind of 4-hour work week and going into this more nourished state of mind, I think about how David Brooks says, in life, we first climb this first mountain of accolades, of prestige, of career, right? When we sit atop that first mountain, we look around and there are people that we meet that are filled with a more pervasive joy than we believe we have. And this might be a surf instructor, it might be a yoga teacher, it might be a shaman, right? And that's when we see there's a second mountain available. The second mountain being composed commitments of service, you know, of that pure alignment. And so I could say that the value of good facilitation is to help us climb that second mountain with support, right? To help us see that the way that we've lived our lives was guided by a high degree of subconscious or unconsciousness. And now we have the availability to take ownership of our choices, right? And choose the way that we feel and choose our path very differently towards greater peacefulness, towards greater joy, towards greater love in our lives, and towards less grief, less apathy, less anger, less resentment. You know, navigating up these layers of consciousness towards enlightenment, which literally means fully enlightened, right? which means shedding the baggage that we are carrying around so long, guiding us, enlightening more and more and more. That's what good facilitators do.
Wow. Thank you for that. That was articulated beautifully, Austin. And so, you know, you mentioned ceremony in church, and I know we have just a little bit of time left. That's something that I'd love to hear a little bit more about. What's the intention of the church? And if somebody listening to this would want to get in touch or is just curious, you know, explain the best way to reach out to you.
Great. Well, Ceremonia can be discovered at ceremoniacircle.org. It's based in Colorado. The mission of this organization, this nonprofit organization, is to scale psychedelic-assisted therapy with a high standard of care and a low unit cost, with sustainable medicines. And what that looks like is a synthesis of, you know, the ancient traditions and ancient technologies of shamanism with modern modalities of modern psychedelic assisted therapy. And so what one would find in ceremony produced by Ceremonia, in a journey produced by Ceremonia, would be kind of the best of both worlds, taking rituals and practices that have been used for thousands of years and then combining that with frameworks, with evidence-based tactics, and with guides who are very practiced and licensed in modern psychedelic-assisted therapy. So I think of it as a very novel approach to this transformative work. We do group ceremonies as you would with ayahuasca, and we wrap around those group ceremonies facilitation and guidance at a very high level.
Wow. And I can't wait to hear more. Thank you for giving the information. If you're watching this on YouTube, in the description, you'll have a link to learn more about Ceremonia. So to wrap things up, Austin, what is it that you could offer to those that are at that peak or even in that valley to kind of keep going? And for someone that has a superpower for process and for getting things done, I think your advice is extremely valuable.
Thank you. You know, when I look at suffering, which can look like anxiety or pain or stress even, or resentment, right? I've discovered a process to reduce suffering and to elevate into higher planes of consciousness, into peacefulness and joy and love. And that process isn't new for me, isn't new to me. I didn't create it. There are many thinkers before me that have come upon the same idea, which is awareness, inquiry, and surrender. So come into awareness of your feelings. You know, so often we seek to avoid or ignore our feelings. Like when we feel sad, we might pick up a beer, right? And seek to avoid that or get on our phone and surf Instagram. Instead, sit with the feeling, acknowledge it, and recognize that the feeling comes from a story that we have, that our ego tells ourselves, right? Recognize what Ram Dass calls the business of reality, that the past already happened, and there's no changing the past, and it is what it is. It brought you to this present moment, right? So coming to awareness. Inquiry is about asking what I call the chain of whys, like, why do I feel this way? Why did I do that? Why do I believe this? And then keep going down like a curious child. Why? To discover the deep-seated belief that we have about ourselves, or that we have about life and the universe, that manifests and projects upwards into this feeling that we have, right? David Hawkins, a spiritual teacher, says that feelings can literally generate thousands of thoughts. Thousands, right? A painful memory might generate so many thoughts over the course of your whole lifetime. So coming into inquiry of what those thoughts are and where they came from is super valuable. And then finally, surrendering. The act of surrender is about letting go of the energy of that feeling, right? And what we find is that one lets go of guilt and shame, that might transmute up to anger, right? Like anger at myself for letting myself devolve that way for so long, or anger at myself for the actions I took because I felt shameful, right? But then you can escalate up into pridefulness, into saying, oh, I can do better. And then finally, the biggest step is to escalate into courage, to say, I am going to choose better. It's the movement from I can't do this. Oh my God, it's too much, to I won't, which is recognizing that I have a choice to do something, and a choice of inaction too, to I want to, which is I have a desire, craving for peacefulness, for freedom from suffering, to I will, which is the commitment, right? I will do this. And then finally, to I am, which is the being, right? Once I take action. And so coming into awareness, all the places that you say I can't, and then start to look at it from a perspective I won't, already is a humongous step. And then the I will is the courage. The courage is the energy for which we can transmute any negative feeling that's holding us down into an act of growth, into greater love for ourselves and for the rest of the world.
Wow. What a beautiful technology you just outlined. So awareness, notice, inquire, ask, and surrender, let go. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Austin, thank you so much for your wisdom. Thank you so much for sharing your journey, even into the deep, dark recesses. I know that those watching this, I'm sure, will extrapolate so much that they can apply to their own lives. We all go through our own journey, and having such successful people that are willing to share the peaks and valleys is doing such a service to the community at large. So thank you, Austin, for your time. Again, anyone who's interested in learning about Austin, anyone who's interested in learning about Ceremonia, please click on the link down there if you're watching this on YouTube. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.